Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, hello, is there anybody in there? I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. Hey, everybody.
Yeah, Joe.
I have a question for you.
Ask away.
Okay.
Are you conscious?
Barely.
Yeah, I was going to make a similar statement, but I will say that I am confident that I'm conscious. I'm not confident that that's my preferable state of being right at this very moment.
Well, I'm not conscious.
So you're just...
I just wanted to get that on the record.
You're just speaking unconsciously. You are channeling some sort of unconscious mind.
No. I'm what some philosophers might refer to as a pee zombie. I display all of the outward appearance of being a conscious entity, but I have no inner experience. I have no qualia, they might say.
Ah, gotcha. Well, the whole purpose of this this charming intro, where we discover that our friend and compatriot Joe is in fact not what he seems to be. That's all he is, I guess,
right.
Is really, so I guess it's the opposite of that. He's exactly what he seems to be and no more than that. We wanted to talk about consciousness. And as it turns out, I mean, this is a subject that has been a matter of discussion in philosophical circles for centuries.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is one of those things like...
You might say millennia.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's evidence of pre-literate cultures having at least some concept of things that tie into consciousness. And there's going to be a lot of vague discussion in this episode, mainly because consciousness is it's tricky to even define it, right?
Yeah, there's sort of a question here. Is consciousness a matter of philosophy, something we just sort of reason and talk about in the abstract? Or is it a question that is susceptible to science? Can you scientifically...
Oh, right. Is there a mechanism that is consciousness?
Yeah.
Is there something that we can point to in the brain and say, this is where consciousness comes from and this is what it means?
Yeah. So for the longest time, this was sort of the realm of the philosophers. There really weren't a whole lot of scientific inroads to consciousness.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where John Locke, the 17th century philosopher, was talking about how consciousness had to be essential for thought and for personal identity. This is, by the way, a view that many philosophers, but not all philosophers, share. We're going to be talking a lot about philosophers early in this episode and just kind of the different perspectives when it comes to consciousness.
Well, yeah, I think the philosophical perspectives are a good way to begin this discussion because we're going to talk about some new scientific discoveries.
That are related to consciousness.
So there's this idea you may have heard of. It's called the hard problem of consciousness. Are you familiar with this?
It's usually what I think when I'm trying desperately to go to sleep and insomnia is taking hold, right? It's the hard problem?
Yeah, that's basically right. No, that's not it at all.
Oh, so, okay. Well, I have a fundamental misunderstanding. Joe, pray, do elaborate and enlighten me.
Okay, so for a while now, some philosophers have divided questions about consciousness into basically two categories. You have the hard problem, and then you have the easy problems, problems plural with easy. So the Australian philosopher David Chalmers, he's written a lot about this, and in a 1995 paper called Facing Up to the Problem of Consciousness, he defined the easy problems as the ones that pretty much everybody can admit can potentially be solved by science.
Okay.
So the easy problems include things like locating the mechanisms behind individual cognitive functions. For example, the ability to discriminate, categorize, and react to environmental stimuli. These are his words now. The integration of information behind a cognitive system, the reportability of mental states, the ability of a system to access its own internal states, the focus of attention, the deliberate control of behavior, the difference between wakefulness and sleep. Those are just some examples he listed. So the idea is, okay, I think pretty much everybody's on board. We can find the things that are happening in the brain,
right,
that cause each of those.
The regions of the brain responsible and the actual processes that manifest
the
in
electrochemical,
these ways.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
These might be, now he called them easy sort of in context. These might in practice be very, very hard to solve.
Easy in the sense that it is probably possible.
Right.
Rather
right.
than something that is probably impossible.
So as difficult as these might be to suss out, what is his hard problem?
Yeah, so Chalmers defines the hard problem as, quote, the problem of experience. And he goes on to say, when we think and perceive, there is a whir of information processing, but there is also a subjective aspect. As Nagel has put it, and he's referring to the philosopher Thomas Nagel, there is, quote, something it is like to be a conscious organism. This subjective aspect is experience. So he also, later on in the paper, sort of tries to say maybe it's easier to just use the term experience rather than consciousness, because that's really what the hard problem of consciousness is all about. What generates this thing we know as experience? You are having an experience right now, Lauren, and you are having one, Jonathan, but I am not having one because I'm a pea zombie. Or Rock probably is not having one as far as we know.
Right.
What causes this? Now, there's this group of people who are often referred to, maybe disparagingly, maybe not, as the new Mysterians. They're the philosophers who have basically concluded that the second problem, the hard problem of consciousness or experience, will never be solved by humans. In other words, while we may learn more and more about the brain and the individual functions of the brain, we're just never really going to be able to understand the origins of this this complex final product of brain called experience.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of different ways you could arrive at this conclusion. There might be some people who could see like a technical problem with the inquiry or the question, say you're not framing it right, or they might define consciousness in such a way that makes the search for a mechanism impossible. Or you could have dualists, who that means somebody who thinks that the mind and the brain are actually separate substances. There's like a soul or an over spirit, mm-hmm. some kind of mm-hmm. other spiritual thing that controls consciousness, and it's just not found in the brain. Or you might have people who accept the problem and the framing of the question, and they agree that there might be a physical basis for the mind, but they just simply don't think that human minds are capable of solving the task. So for an example, the final one, I found a quote by the British philosopher Colin McGinn in a 2012 piece for the New Statesman called All Machine and No Ghost? So he says, paleoanthropologists have taught us that the human brain gradually evolved from ancestral brains, particularly in concert with practical tool-making, centering on the anatomy of the human hand. This history shaped and constrained the form of intelligence now housed in our skulls, as the lifestyle of other species formed their set of cognitive skills. What chance is there that an intelligence geared to making stone tools and grounded in the contingent particularities of the human hand can aspire to uncover all the mysteries of the universe? Can omniscience spring from an opposable thumb? It seems unlikely, so why presume that the mysteries of consciousness will be revealed to a thumb-shaped brain like ours? The, quote, Mysterianism, unquote, I advocate, is really nothing more than the acknowledgement that human intelligence is a local, contingent, temporal, practical, and expendable feature of life on Earth, an incremental adaptation based on earlier forms of intelligence that no one would regard as fairly omniscient.
I would argue that just his ability to frame it in such a way kind of dismisses his own argument at some extent, because what sort of, how would you say that if you take his premise that, you know, all of our achievement is, and I know he's making a point, he's oversimplifying,
right.
But if you take his premise that a lot of our achievements are all due to this whole opposable thumb approach, you would never have reached a point where you could even frame an argument in that sense. I think it helps disprove itself.
I get it. It's sort of a agnosticism of we don't know and we can't know. I find that
personally a little pessimistic. I mean, I think of some of the achievements that we have already as a species seen. I mean, not even recent ones, I'm talking throughout all of human history, that to me suggests that you should never really underestimate human ability and achievement.
Yeah, I don't want to dismiss this point of view out of hand, the point of view expressed by McGinn and the quote I read. Like, I think there's some intelligence behind it.
Absolutely.
There is some interesting thinking, but in the end, I can't really go along with it.
Yeah, I appreciate what he's saying, and let's go ahead and say this. I am absolutely certain that he is far more intelligent than I am. I do not mean to suggest otherwise. I just do not agree with that particular philosophy.
Well, as science-minded people, or rather two science-minded people and some kind of weird automaton, we have to believe that, I mean, you know, we like to believe generally that science is going to come up with answers for
all of
the mysteries of the universe.
So I guess that forces us to ask the question, has science found anything interesting that might bear on this question? So is there anything we can come back at the Mysterians with right now?
Well, before we get into that, let's first just address the fact that this has been a difficult problem for science, not just for philosophy, because the human brain, as we have discussed in previous episodes of Forward Thinking, is a complex little critter.
Yeah, and to kind of devil's advocate for the... yes, I verb that noun all the time.
I love that. Please do that all the time.
Advocate devilishly, Lauren.
For the point of view that we can't figure this kind of thing out, we certainly haven't yet. Like, we've got a few leads.
Sure.
And there's one in specific that we're going to be talking about.
Right.
But there's so much about the brain that we don't know.
Yeah, I described it in the episode as if we have a general map that's missing tons of detail. So we know the general parameters of the human brain. We know some of the regions. We know what some of the regions do, or at least we have very strong evidence supporting what those regions of the brain do. But when you start getting beyond that, it gets really murky really fast.
And it's not like one of the GPS units is down or something like that. It's more like there be dragons.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah. This is the earliest days when cartographers were making observations of landscapes and doing their best to represent that so that future generations won't run their ships upon the breakers, right? That's the whole kind of place we're in neurologically speaking as far as brain science goes. That's not to say that we don't have top scientists working on it right now. We do. But it is one of those things where we can't just easily say this is exactly how this particular brain function works. I mean, in our discussion about memory, we talked about how we've made a lot of progress toward understanding memory, but that's just progress toward it. We don't have a full working like document saying this is how we encode and decode memory, how we recall memory, how we re-encode it so that we can recall it again later, and exactly what the mechanism is. If we had that and we knew exactly how it worked, we could probably even work on ways to improve memory so that it's actually reliable. but you know, we can't. So we have to first be completely honest about that the brain is still very much at large a thing of mystery to us.
One of the other things I think we should acknowledge is the limitations that some are practical, some might be ethical on what we can do
right.
with the brain. I mean, so you can do fMRI.
Yes.
You can put somebody in a scanner and look at which parts of the brain are getting blood flow and lighting up with activity. You can do experiments like that, but those kinds of experiments only show you so much.
Right. And to get really into the nitty and or gritty of the brain, one often has to pop the top, as in remove part of the skull and put some probes on in there. And as it turns out,
little electrical or chemical sensors.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. You gotta zap some cells. Essentially, is what we're talking about. And here's the issue here: it's hard to get people to volunteer to be part of such an experiment.
Yeah, that's not a nice thing to do to somebody unless they've agreed to it.
Yeah, so you're right. So if you're not, if they
right.
haven't agreed
yeah.
to it,
you
there's the ethical
be doing
issue,
it.
Right? Yeah.
And B, right, that's not really my idea of a fun Tuesday.
Right. If I'm going, like, I think about, I take the train to and from work, right? And every time I take the train, there's always some advertisement somewhere for some sort of medical study.
Sure.
And they're targeting students mainly who are able to have the time and the willingness to put themselves through some sort of study, and they get a small compensation for doing so. I cannot imagine a compensation great enough for your average student to say, yeah, I don't mind if you shave my head, cut open my skull, insert a probe, and mess around. So it's really hard to do fundamental research on living brains in an ethical and responsible way. So that's one of the big reasons why our knowledge is so limited. It's that, practically speaking, it's hard to do. So that being said, we can definitely talk about some efforts that science has made in order to really understand consciousness. And one of them totally blows my mind.
Are you talking about Max?
Yeah, our buddy, Tegmark. Max Tegmark of MIT. By buddy, I mean someone that has no idea who we are and we have never met. But Max Tegmark of MIT has proposed that we think of consciousness as a new state of matter. So we've got, you know, we've got solid, liquid, gas, plasma, consciousness. Yeah. So he has proposed let's call it a hypothetical form of matter called.
Oh, he calls it a hypothesis.
Yeah,
he's not saying this is something I found out.
But it's called perceptonium, which, like unobtainium and transformium, is largely an imaginary substance. But the reason why he proposes it is so that scientists can start to think about consciousness as if it is a physical substance, in order to start applying various scientific and mathematical principles to the various elements of consciousness. It's really all about...
It's a placeholder.
Yeah.
Sort of the same way that...
Dark energy, dark matter, mm-hmm. or the Higgs boson until we discovered it. Not us, personally. I mean, we were busy that day.
I didn't.
No, but scientists discovered it. So it's really a placeholder, but it's meant to be something that allows scientists to kind of conceive of consciousness in a way that makes it more more solid in a way, an idea where they can actually start forming various scientific theories about it and testing them.
I think what he sort of said he wanted was to create a framework where we could do mathematics.
Exactly.
With respect to thinking.
Yeah, the idea of exploring how the physical laws of the universe themselves could give rise to consciousness, and also ultimately allow us to better understand how it is we perceive the world the way we do and why we do. And by the way, if you guys listening at home ever hear any rumbling, we're doing this apparently in the middle of an amazing thunderstorm.
Yeah.
I don't suggest that such thunderstorm is conscious, by the way.
Okay, we can agree to disagree on that. Okay.
Yeah, if you're a panpsychist, you might think that cloud has some rudimentary form of consciousness.
Yeah. At any rate, so we've been talking about consciousness as with the potential that it is a physical bit of matter, perhaps.
Right.
So if it's a physical thing, and if perhaps it operates vaguely like computers, does it have an on-off switch?
That's a interesting question that you asked, and I'm glad you did, because the answer appears to be maybe. I'm definitely hedging my bets on this one because, as you'll see when we talk about this case, there are a lot of things you have to take into consideration.
Absolutely.
Which means that making any kind of yes or no statement would be premature,
right.
I would say.
Well, as a preface, yeah, we're about to tell you a story that is very interesting, but we don't know for sure if it means what we think it means.
Right.
Right.
But it's certainly exciting.
Yeah.
So
tell the story.
Here's the story. Once upon a time, there was a team of doctors who were working at George Washington University, and they were working with a patient who suffered from epilepsy. Mm-hmm. Now, epilepsy is caused by having abnormal activity in the brain. The neurons fire abnormally. Usually, you can think of it as just an overload of discharging neurons in a way.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it manifests itself in various types of symptoms. Not all of them are the dramatic seizures that we often think of as an epileptic fit. Some of them are things where someone just loses focus, but it often will be accompanied by a loss of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these doctors weren't necessarily looking for anything that had to relate to consciousness. What they were looking for was what part of this patient's brain was responsible for triggering these seizures.
They were doing a case study. So they were kind of basically poking around and stimulating different bits of her brain.
Exactly.
In order to kind of see what happened.
Yeah, it's kind of... it makes me think of the scene in Buckaroo Banzai where they're performing brain surgery and Buckaroo Banzai says to one of his fellow surgeons, no, don't touch that. You never know what it's connected to. So in this case, what they were doing was they were stimulating, like you said, different regions of the brain. And at one point, they reach a part of the brain called the claustrum. And when they use the electrodes to stimulate that part of the brain, the patient would stop whatever she was doing. She would gradually lose consciousness. It didn't sound like it was a instant thing. It sounded more like it was a process. So she would lose consciousness and then just sort of stare off into the distance, not at anything in particular,
mm-hmm.
until they stopped stimulating that part of the brain, in which case she would recover but have no recollection of the moments that had passed while that part of her brain was being stimulated.
Almost as if it had just never happened.
Yeah. So if anyone's ever had one of those moments where, you know, you've blacked out for one reason or another, it could be a reaction to medication. It could be head trauma. It could be an epileptic seizure,
mm-hmm.
whatever. If it's one of those moments where you are now alert, you remember exactly what you were doing before you had that moment, but you have no recollection of what happened in between and other people have to tell you and you just have to go on what they said. That's what was going on scientifically in the lab at this moment. And again, the doctors were not looking for this. They just happened to stumble upon it.
Right.
And so it was at that point where they said, you know, it's possible that the claustrum, this thin membrane that's under the neocortex in the brain, this thin membrane, it may be the key, the on-off switch for consciousness, not to say that it's ultimately responsible for what we call consciousness, but it might be one element that without it, you can't have consciousness. It might be like the linchpin that ties everything together.
Right, because there are a lot of different ways of explaining what consciousness exactly would be or if it would have a location within the brain, but an interesting way of thinking about it is, okay, so you have lots of different things going on in your brain at any given time. You're processing visual data.
Mm-hmm.
You're processing auditory data. You're accessing memories from mm-hmm. the past. You are having motor control. You're speaking. And somehow all of these things come together in our brain to create this thing we think of as experience.
Right.
Yep.
But all of these things are separate.
Yeah.
So what's combining them for us in this way? What's creating the thing that makes a continuous, conscious, single experience? It could be that there is one organ in the brain that takes everything and smashes it together and makes you an experience.
And previous research has suggested that that thing might in fact be the claustrum. Back in 2004, Francis Crick, who's one of the guys who helped suss out the structure of DNA back in the 1950s, along with Christoph Koch, who is a prominent neuroscientist, noted that the claustrum receives input from and projects output to almost all of the regions of the cortex. And they speculated that if, you know, the philosophical concept of consciousness is indeed the sum of cooperative activity of the senses and the nervous system together, that the claustrum might be certainly worth further study. This was backed up in 2012 when another group of researchers published a paper hypothesizing that, I mean, well basically that these guys were correct based on studies that they did of signals that were being relayed into and out of the claustrum. They observed it receiving signals from several areas of the brain and sending signals out specifically to the motor cortex. And so therefore thought that it might be controlling lots of interactive processes through the brain and voluntary behavior as well. They were a little bit less philosophical about it than some of the other people we've been talking about. They kind of concluded that the claustrum's control, quote, may include the neural correlates of consciousness.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that's still, I mean, for science dudes, pretty high philosophical.
Yeah, that's, yeah,
well,
that's,
yeah, I think that's proper scientific rhetorical humility.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. And so, this result here, you know, I hesitate. I can't really call it a study because, again, that wasn't necessarily what they were looking for. But this result that the doctors found at George Washington University, yeah,
mm-hmm.
that seems to, again, give more evidence for support for that particular point of view. It definitely feels like this gives more support for that, the idea that consciousness is a manifestation of neurophysical processes,
mm-hmm.
that there is something to do with the brain, that the mind and the brain are one and the same. The mind itself is a manifestation of the brain. That's what it seems to support. Now, all that being said, here are some of those facts that we mentioned at the top we were going to have to bring into context in this discussion, because you can't make any sweeping scientific conclusion based upon this one incident.
Right. This was a case study. And a case study, if you have never heard that particular medical term before, means that you are looking at a single patient at a single point in time, and you're not even trying to draw any other data into the argument.
Right.
Right.
So when you have
it's a nifty observation.
Right. You've got one example, and that's it. So that means that, first of all, you can't definitely conclude that that one example is representative of everyone's experience as a whole.
Right. Also, it makes a really boring chart.
Yeah. You have 100%, right? Because you've got the one person.
100% of participants.
Yeah. Of one participant. Yeah. So you have to keep in mind the sample size is a sample size of one. So you can't make any sweeping scientific conclusion based on the sample size of one.
On top of that, I think I read somewhere, Jonathan, you might be able to confirm this, that this particular patient's brain was probably not what we would call typical.
Right. She had had a previous surgical procedure done where part of her hippocampus had been removed. Now, the hippocampus, as we've discussed in our optogenetics episode, is the part of the brain that's associated with forming memory. And so she had had part of that removed in a previous surgery. So her experience may not be typical of someone else's experience for that reason as well.
Also, I mean, she had a pre-existing neurological condition suffering
right.
from
epilepsy.
Pretty extreme yeah. epilepsy.
Yeah.
So it might be that this particular individual's brain is affected by stuff in the way that somebody else's brain might not be.
Right. So you have to take all those sort of caveats into mind before you go any further. And to make matters more complicated, we get back round to that problem we mentioned earlier. To do further study would require some pretty invasive procedures, right? I mean, it's not
right.
like we can easily say, oh, hey, get Jim in here and let's find out if it works on him too.
Yeah. I'm really interested in this. I'm not going to sign up for that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, it makes sense in this case because this was sort of a byproduct of attempted therapy, right?
Oh, like,
exactly.
Trying
yeah.
to help this patient.
Right. This wasn't a case of, well, this person is already in this particular situation. Let's see if we can get them to agree to help us just do some exploratory research. That wasn't the case. The case was they were specifically trying to make this woman's life better. They were trying to figure out what is it that's causing these epileptic seizures so we can understand that better and not only help her, but potentially, if we learn enough about epilepsy in general, help future people who suffer from epilepsy.
And as it turns out, this study might help even more people than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As it turns out, if in fact this claustrum ends up being that on-off switch, if it ends up being the kind of the gateway for us to understand more scientifically about what consciousness is and its role and how the mechanisms work, not saying we're there yet, but if this happens to lead to more research that does extend that understanding, we might be able to see some practical applications that could demonstrably make people's lives better. For example, there are people who suffer various ailments that impact their ability to have awareness of themselves and the environment around them. For example, people who are in a comatose state.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that by understanding more about the mechanisms of consciousness, we can create new therapies that would help people come out of comatose states, or people who have suffered from amnesia, which, you know, it sounds pretty similar. The idea that you have lost big blocks of time, you have no recollection of it, kind of coincides with this idea of, well, when you are unconscious, you're not collecting memories anymore. So maybe there's another relationship there, an interrelationship between memory and consciousness that we could further explore and perhaps help people who have suffered from these kind of ailments.
One thing that I thought was really interesting and might bear on the potential applications is the distinction that you noted here in the notes. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good one to make between wakefulness and consciousness.
Right.
This was something that was observed in this particular case, right? It's the idea that being awake and being conscious are different things.
Right.
You might say in even kind of a weird way that you could be considered conscious while you're asleep, say if you're having dreams or mm-hmm. something.
Right.
That you're still having an experience. So what if you were to flip that, to say that you are in fact awake, but you're not conscious?
And that was one of those things that has been a matter of debate in philosophy for generations, right? The idea, a lot of philosophers kind of combined wakefulness and consciousness as very much interrelated, and that you could not have...
Separate the two out.
Yeah, you couldn't have consciousness without wakefulness, was the idea. But apparently you can have wakefulness without consciousness. Now, philosophically, perhaps you would debate whether or not the patient was truly wakeful, right? She was not asleep.
Yeah.
But she was also
getting
not...
Getting into definitions of words at that
point.
Well,
that's the thing. That's what philosophy
absolutely.
Does.
Yeah. No. I know.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to define wakefulness as, say, being able to, say, have motor control, like you can say words. Well, I don't know. People do that in their sleep. It is hard to define.
It is. Yeah. It's tricky. I mean, brain stuff is tricky, yo. That was going to be the alternate title of this particular episode. Brain stuff is tricky, yo. But I figured I could not pull that off. So.
But all of that aside, even this research could help with the originally intended study.
Yep.
As it turns out, the patient's loss of consciousness was associated with increased synchronized activity across a few different parts of her brain. And as we mentioned earlier, kind of similar things happen during epileptic seizures. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an overwhelming electrical bit in the brain that happens. Okay.
Yeah.
So the researchers think that minor synchronized activity means the brain is binding different aspects of an experience together, but that too much here might be overwhelming and disrupt the cohesion of thoughts or even consciousness as a whole. So up next in the future, they're going to be investigating whether a more mild stimulus to the region might kind of jolt the brain activity back to normal and prevent the seizure from
ever
continuing.
Interesting. Wow. Very
really
interesting.
Cool.
Yeah. Sort of like a pacemaker for seizures.
Wow. And then on top of that, our understanding of consciousness could extend beyond humans. We may be able to start looking at the concept of consciousness as it applies to other organisms.
Oh, right.
Wow.
Yeah, because all of the mammals whose brains we've investigated so far have a claustrum.
Yeah.
Yep. But some animals probably don't.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, there's so non-mammals may not have this. And so the question is, well, first of all, you have to assume that the claustrum does in fact play a key role in consciousness.
If we were to discover that.
Yeah. So if that holds true, then does that mean that mammals have at least some level of consciousness? And again, this may mean that we have to start better defining what consciousness is, perhaps creating a spectrum of consciousness, and whether, you know, when you say an animal is conscious, what does that actually mean within the spectrum, right?
Yeah, and it's really interesting to have this very concrete thing to look at as opposed to previous tests of consciousness that are a little bit more psychological. There's, for example, what's called the mirror test, wherein you take a critter, put a glob of something on its face, stick it in front of a mirror. If the critter tries to wipe the thing off of its face, that means that it is recognizing itself in the mirror and realizing that it's got something there and is going like, ah, get it off.
As opposed to either thinking that whatever the thing is in the mirror is another creature or not recognizing it as something at all.
Right, exactly. And there are a few animals that can pass this mirror test. The great apes, dolphins, orca, elephants, and the European magpie, actually. So one bird is in there as well.
Interesting.
But, you know, that's not always a terrific test, even for all animals. Like, if you did that to an octopus, it would fail the test. However, octopi use tools and
they show amazing ingenuity to problem-solving skills.
Yeah, and some might even, I think, question the definition of consciousness that's being approached there. I mean, that seems to raise that difference between consciousness and self-consciousness. Like, is one having an experience versus is one, having an image of the self?
Yeah, an awareness of the self in some form. Yeah, again, this is where
more
it starts
definitions
getting...
definitions
yeah,
and
gets
philosophy.
All, it gets
sure.
all super fuzzy. Mm-hmm. Not to mention some of the animals are also super fuzzy.
They are.
Then,
especially octopi.
So the way I concluded the episode, the video episode, is really how we're going to kind of wrap up this one, too. The idea that... if we are, in fact, on the pathway to getting a better grip, scientifically speaking, on the mechanisms of consciousness, if we get to a point where, let's say, 10 to 20 years, or however, whatever, you know, the X unit of time that means a long time from now, but not so long
not
as to be...
not inconceivably long.
Right.
Yeah.
That somewhere in that time frame, we get to a point where we have a really keen understanding of what's going on within the brain as far as consciousness is concerned. It doesn't seem like that far of a stretch. Granted, right now we don't know anything, but that far of a stretch that we might be able to replicate that, to simulate that in some way, and then to give that state to an artificial being, a machine, and have machine consciousness.
Kind of scary.
I mean, one of the big limitations right now that people say there to having like an artificially intelligent machine that has that strong AI human-like intelligence, which for a lot of people also includes this idea of sentience and self-awareness. It doesn't have to have that, but for a lot of people's concept, that usually goes hand in hand. That a lot of people say, well, that's almost impossible to do because we don't understand it in ourselves. But it could be that the stuff we're seeing today is just that gentle creak of the door opening, just a little tiny crack, and that maybe in a few decades we'll have actually understood enough where that will no longer be the limiting factor. Now, there may be some other limiting factor that eventually tells us we cannot create a simulation of this. But the interesting thing here is saying, look, we're starting to learn things scientifically about consciousness, and this was something that some philosophers thought was an impossibility.
Yeah.
So I find it really exciting. I did try and caution people saying this stuff is years or decades away from it ever being something that is practical in any
yes.
use, because we don't even know what we know yet. And until we have that settled, we can't start building on it. But it is really exciting.
Yeah.
Anything else you guys want to add before we try and brave the terrible tsunami that's outside?
I think it's let up.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm actually feeling pretty good about it right now, which is kind of why I'm thinking there's a break in the clouds. We should conclude and get out of here.
Yes.
All right. So on that note, ladies and gentlemen, remember, if you have any suggestions for future episodes or any questions for us, anything like that, let us know on Facebook, Twitter, or Google+. Our handle at all three is FW Thinking, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.